Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Heroin use has exploded on Delmarva. We'll take a look at the impact and what's to be done. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In Maryland, there was a 33% increase in drug overdose deaths for the first quarter of this year. And of the 252 total drug overdose deaths, 148 were related to heroin. In Delaware, heroin sales have significantly spiked since late 2010. Delaware State Police say in 2011 there were 500 heroin-related investigations. By 2012, it had doubled to 1,000 and was still climbing by last year. Authorities say the new heroin is more pure and can be ingested through the nose instead of being injected or smoked. While the state authorities have struggled with the new rise of the drug, there is a group called Attack Addiction. In our studio, our guests are Donald Keister and his wife, Jeannie, along with their daughter, Courtney, and they founded the group. They lost their son, Tyler, in 2012, the age of 24, to a heroin overdose, and they are, of course, the founders of this group, Attack Addiction. Welcome, first of all, to the program.
Thank you.
And my condolences, certainly, on the loss of your son. And I want to actually turn to your son first to give some human sense to this, because there are a lot of images about who junkies are, quote-unquote, people who use. And I want to begin with, what was he like, I mean, as a kid? What can you describe who he was, before all of this happened?
Yeah, Mom can probably do a little bit better job.
Well, he was just your typical neighborhood kid. He was athletic. He was very smart. He didn't work very hard in school, but he was very smart and was an honor roll student. He just was real popular, funny, witty, and he went to a private high school. Played football, and they were state champion football team. So he's athletic, and he's very proud of that. And it's not who you think it's going to happen to.
He was the All-American kid, and I think that's really what we're finding. The demographics of this problem, it's not what you usually see with living under a bridge or out on the street. It's the it's some of the higher price suburban areas, home areas that this is affecting, and it's it affects everyone. But it's no longer in the inner city and in those areas.
Courtney, tell me a little bit about what you remember from your brother growing up with him.
Well, yeah, he was quite a character, very witty, as my mom had mentioned, and very kind to everyone around him as well. You know, a little ornery sometimes, as little brothers can be, but, yeah, he was great. Always was thinking about others, didn't always apply himself, as my mom had said, to his highest potential, but, you know, that's very typical of a lot of teenagers. But I think that they really, described him well. Very athletic, smart. He really had the whole package. Anything that he wanted, he could have had.
So when did you get a sense that something was awry, Donald?
Well, during high school, we were aware that he was experimenting. And statistics show that 8 out of 10 do experiment in high school. It's a choice to experiment. But after he graduated from high school and spent a semester at Wesley College and didn't go to classes. He partied the whole semester, and he was gone by the end of that time. He got a job, worked for a while, but soon realized he needed help. And we got on the computer, and he found a place in Colorado that he wanted to go to seek help and try to get clean. He went to Colorado, stayed there for a year and a half, got himself clean, had a job, was living on his own, doing very well. He got a little homesick, decided to come back. And different relapses caused throughout the next 2 or 3 years, and until he succumbed to an overdose.
When did you get a sense that this had moved from, say, simple experimentation, which a lot of people do throughout their entire lives, to heroin, which is when people think about heroin, that's a giant leap from, say, smoking marijuana, for example, in terms of how people look at it.
Well, I think what you have to realize is that they take on these pills, these opiate pills, and they're every bit as strong and sometimes even stronger than heroin. And what occurs is they steal these pills from their relatives, grandparents, or what have you. And once they, once they can't afford the pills anymore, the heroin is very cheap compared and very easy to get. It's one of the ways they move to the heroin.
Jeannie?
I think it was pretty much when he went to college that things were really out of control, became out of control for him. I think that he was accountable on the weekends when he was to come home at night. If he was going to spend the night at a friend's house, we called the friend's parents to verify. And I think even though there was probably experimentation then, I think it was once he went to college and he was on his own that he, probably partied more. And I think probably is when the addiction really grabbed him.
What moment did you realize he was using heroin?
Well, when he was going to Colorado, that's when he told us that what the problem was opiates that he was addicted to. And it was all pills at that point, but he told us painkillers are opiates, and that's what heroin is. I don't think it ever became the form of heroin until the summer of 2012 when Prescription Drug Action Committee made it harder for prescription pills to become available. And I think that's when it turned to the heroin form then, is when he couldn't get his hands on the pain pills.
What was your reaction when he told you, as he said, I need to go to Colorado, that he had a serious problem? I mean, was it a surprise? What was your own personal moment there?
The fact that he was addicted to pain pills, yes, that was a surprise. We thought it was the alcohol. We thought it was probably the pot. Any risky behaviors were a concern to me. I was shocked about that. We knew that he had been staying out late after work and coming in, late. And so the whole addiction to the opiates was a shock to us. We were concerned about some of his partying ways, but we were shocked about the opiates.
What about you, Donald? What was going through your mind when he finally said, hey?
Well, first of all, when he said he was willing to go to Colorado and he wanted to seek help, I thought that was a positive step. I was glad that he wanted to do something to get himself back on. How serious his problem was, I wasn't 100% sure. I knew he had a problem, and he admitted he had a problem. So I was optimistic when he decided he wanted to go to Colorado and get some help.
By the way, I have to ask this. Did you have any sense, or did you, in your thinking, in your own mind, that his parents, that somehow you had went wrong, or was there anything that you could have done? I mean, well, Jeannie,
I had a lot of guilt for a long time, but it took me until Courtney talked me into going to an Al-Anon meeting. Tyler, the whole entire time that this was going on, Tyler kept saying, it's not your fault. And we used to say, even if we forgot to tell our kids something along the way, we live by example. And I think what it took me until probably about October of 2012, right before his relapse and we lost him, was to realize that it truly is a disease. And he truly was a good person. This disease caused him to have some behaviors at the end that he was not proud of. He stole some money from us. He stole some jewelry from us. He was devastated by that. But the disease part comes in, that these aren't bad people trying to be good. They're sick people trying to get well.
Courtney, I want to turn to you. What was your sense about what was going on as this unfolded? I mean, were you surprised at his problem or what?
When we were kids, teenagers, I kind of knew he was trying some things, and I just figured it was, teenager things. And I remember my mom being really worried about it, and I thought she was overreacting. Mm-hmm. And I kind of tried to not know as much as I could, because I didn't want, I was like, well, you know, I don't want all this, like, pressure on me about things. So I tried to know as little as I could. You know, I thought that when he came back from Colorado that, excuse me, I thought that he was better and fine and we could go and be normal and, you know, do things together. And that was not the case.
Donald, so he comes back from Colorado, but then there are these relapses. Did you get a sense that there was now a downward spiral, or was there a continuing sort of sense of hope or optimism that maybe this time you turn the corner?
Well, you're always hoping for that. And it's something you live with all your life, I'm afraid. He came to the beach and relapsed. And when he came back, he decided to go to a methadone clinic. And that was his way of trying to get well. The whole way, the whole time that your son is there, your values of getting a job, being a good citizen, having your benefits, all those things you're thinking about, and the reality is they don't mean a thing. What really means something is getting well and getting yourself back together. And that was a hard thing for me to realize. I was very, very encouraged when he went to methadone. He got a job at a local bank. The people that he worked with loved him. He was doing great selling. He had the most people buying credit cards from him, and people would ask for him when they came into the bank. He spent 7 months using the methadone and working very well. We then found out that not only was he addicted to methadone, he was also addicted to the heroin. Both of those things, and there were not a lot of places to detox that would detox both. We did find a place in Florida, and that was costly at $1,000 a day. He spent 11 days there and then went to a rehab. And he wanted to be rid of both the methadone and the heroin. Methadone is used as a medical treatment, and I guess it's successful for some, but it didn't work for him.
So when did you find out that, or how did you find out that it didn't work, that he had passed away?
Well, it was, we got a call from my daughter, my other daughter, that someone had told her that Tyler was in the hospital. He had been taken there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He was in a motel when they found him. And they really didn't do anything to contact us, but the person recognized him and called my daughter, and she called me. When we went to the hospital, the doctor said his brain is stopped working. He won't make it through the night. He actually made it for 3 days, we had an opportunity to say goodbye, and a lot of people came and did the same thing. He also donated his organs to several people.
And now, obviously, there's this sense of loss, but for the two of you, you turned around and said, okay, we're going to do something about this. How did that happen? I mean, give me some sense about what the aftermath was like and how you came to this, because a lot of people would have just given up or moved on or whatever. I mean, what?
Well, as he was laying there, brain dead, I spoke to Jeannie's dad and said, you know, I think I'm going to take some pictures. He was on life support, and maybe I can take this into some schools and show them what this looked like and what can happen. I work in a school, and Jeannie and Courtney both work in schools, and we thought maybe the education of – you try to make some sense out of your child's passing, and you want to find some kind of value and some kind of reason, and it carries up and stirs up emotions very often, but I think it's worth what we're doing to give some light, some support to his life.
Jeannie, what about you?
Well, Tyler was not proud of this. He didn't want us to talk about it. He had a lot of shame. And we lived it. This was a secret in our life because we respected that. And then I think what we learned while he was at rehab was we needed to start talking about it. But at the same time, there's the discrimination, and he needs to move forward in his life and have a job and do all those things without sabotaging that. So when he did not survive his first overdose, we decided we need to start talking about it. And we felt like that his life took this path for some reason. And with Don being the head of a school and Courtney having eighth graders, teaching eighth graders, we felt that this was the reason that maybe we needed to start talking about it. And since we started talking about it, Don named the group Attack Addiction. Tyler's initials are TAK, Tyler Armstrong Keister. And we probably have about 60 people who, all affected by the same problem, have come together, and the power of strength to get us all through. And I think only because of those people are we able to do what we're doing. It's all of them supporting us, and together we support each other.
Courtney, I know this is difficult. I was curious about your involvement in the group, because I noticed as I went through the list of benefit board members, there was your name and your picture. Yeah. So you obviously feel very strongly about this. And you indicated a moment ago that during the addiction, it was sort of like you didn't really want to know. I mean, it was sort of like a protection. How did that change? I mean, what you know, you're now fairly prominent in the sense, at least, that you know you're out there as a member of this group.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely been a very big part of my healing process, knowing that something better is coming from our tragedy. Sorry, I can't keep it together. But it's been very healing to do things and not just to sit back and, you know, wallow in, you know, our sadness and, you know, just knowing that we can be there for others who are going through these similar things. Some people aren't ready to talk about their families or their own addiction issues. But, you know, our first meeting, people who were there and were addicts said, we don't want to be anonymous anymore. We want to have a voice and a face to it. So, you know, we aren't anonymous, and I just have noticed, you know, there's so many people that are affected by this and so many that tell us what of help this has been to them. You know, it's also helped given me some direction as I am in working on a dissertation, and, you know, I realize that this is where my focus needs to be, and so hoping to continue to learn and make changes from where we are now. So
I mean, one of the things that, by the way, you mentioned a moment ago, Donald, is that he was on methadone for a while, and he became addicted to that. And one of the things, I was already reading some of the literature, and there are obviously people who think at least this at least provides some kind of outlet. Some suggest, by the way, it may be more of a public safety issue rather than necessarily getting off of drugs altogether. I think one person said that they could actually be on from 18 months to eternity. I mean, in terms of, so what, as your someone's taking this drug methadone, did you see an improvement? What was your sense about, I mean, obviously in the end it didn't work, but
yeah, methadone has been around for a long time, and it's been a substitute for the opiate. I think it's a method that we have for medical treatment, a method that is used right now by a number of organizations and has been successful for some. I think the key here is that when you use methadone, you have to be counseled. They have to observe how much you're using. And I guess it was fairly easy to increase the dosages, to talk the suppliers into increasing that. And I think the counseling and working along with the methadone would be what's needed. And I'm not sure that occurs all the time. Another one is Suboxone that people right. use as a medical treatment, and there are tools that organizations have to use. And I guess for some they've been successful, but I think they certainly do need to be monitored maybe a little more closely than they currently are.
By the way, now, as I was reading, a lot of the problems, particularly in Delaware, has been just that there's not a lot of facilities, and whether it's the state, that kind of thing. Were you surprised at that, especially given that there are a large number of people who are affected, certainly family members and friends, and that the death rate and the usage seems to be going up?
It's true, and that's something that the state is working on. There's one detox facility in the whole state. People from Sussex County may go, may go up there and get turned away because they're full. I think they have around 50 beds. 26 of them are assigned to the state that they can use for people that may not have insurance. But obviously, the one detox place is not sufficient, and they are working on some more. In addition, there's no detox facility for minors. You have to be over 18 to go to that facility. So there's counseling groups that deal with juveniles, but there's not a detox facility in the state of Delaware for the minors.
Why wouldn't there be? Or is there like other avenues? Why is that? Do you think?
Well, I know when we were going through this with Tyler, we didn't know. 19 months ago, we knew nobody. We knew one other family who had a child in this situation. We knew nobody, and I found it amazing that how many people are connected. We had a 5K. We had 900 people on March 1st show up for a 5K race, the worst winter ever. We had more than 700 pre-register. But I think that the state probably knew about it, but the public wasn't talking about it. The state and DHSS, they are very well aware of what the problem is, and they are working very hard when making changes. And I think it used to be treated more as a criminal aspect, where now they're recognizing the medical aspect first. And they're working hard on making a difference. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's very frustrating because there's nothing more desperate than trying to get the person that you care about help when they need help, and then they're willing to take the help. But they are working on making a plan. It's complicated with insurance. It's complicated with Medicare, Medicaid. But they're working hard on making a difference.
But what about the cost? I mean, you indicated a moment ago that you could send somebody down to Florida, but it's like $1,000 or whatever. I mean, what about the cost of trying to get a son or a daughter or a spouse or whomever into this? I mean, is it just simply prohibitive, or is there ways around that? What do you?
Well, I guess that depends on your insurance and how that is. Of course, there's a parity in the Obama new health care that is supposed to be a parity with mental health and addiction, similar to any other disease. And I'm not sure that that's kicked in yet, but we have met with some insurance companies. They're going to consider it similar and treat it the same way. Not only was it expensive to send him there, but it was the only place we could find that would detox him on the methadone and the heroin. So the facilities are hard to find. They're expensive. There's a facility in anyone you go to. It's, it's $20,000 to $40,000 a month to have someone in there. Now, the insurance, some insurances will cover a bit of it. When Tyler finished his 11 days detoxing, he went to a rehab that was in Florida. Insurance picked up all but a couple $1,000 of that 30-day stay. So it varies on your insurance. It varies on where you are and where you send them and what your specific needs might be.
So when you were faced with that, I mean, was particularly the kind of numbers you were talking about, were you taken aback when you realized that this could cost a lot of money? I mean, and asking yourself, do I have the resources or how I can get the resources? I mean, I can imagine a family of modest means who might be facing this. They may or may not have insurance. What do they do?
Yeah, there is help for them. Yeah. There is help for them and those that don't have insurance. In fact, sometimes when you go to these facilities, you may be better off without insurance if the state or someone, Medicaid, can help you out. So it just varies from location to location and place to place, and it is difficult. I was fortunate. It strapped us a bit to spend that kind of money, but I think it was something we needed to do in this case.
And one of the things I find frustrating is Tyler had a full-time job with the bank. He had Blue Cross Blue Shield on his own. He was 24, so he was still covered under my Blue Cross Blue Shield through the state of Delaware. And he, like Don said, we paid for the 11, 12 days for his detox. And then he went to the rehab. When he finished rehab, he felt like he needed more time. But he was denied services because he had just had his first and only 30-day rehab. Well, we keep getting a bill. Well, we keep getting a statement. It's not a bill from Blue Cross Blue Shield about his 4-day stay in the hospital when he was on life support. Well, he it took a few days for him to be declared brain dead. But that bill was a heck of a lot more than it would have cost for them to send him to another 30 days worth of rehab, which might have been the 30 days that he needed. So I find that to be frustrating. But
Courtney, you indicated you're doing some of your academic work on this. Tell me a little bit about that.
I certainly have found a passion with this a lot. I'm in the process of researching a lot of background information on addiction and drugs and, the ways it affects the brain. And I'm definitely still in the early stages, but, you know, my outcome of my research is really going to be looking at people's perceptions of our group. So, you know, I think that'll be really powerful to know what others think of us so that we can continue to head in the right direction with our group and be as helpful as we can to as many people as possible.
Yeah, because I know that, for instance, there is alluded this a moment ago that there is a sense or an image of someone who's a junkie. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see these images all the time on police shows and attorney shows and so on. And yet, as I read it, I mean, most actually are white suburbanite, often middle class. I mean, have you found that's the case?
Yeah, it's certainly very much affecting the middle class. I know middle-aged women are, and as well as the elderly, are also very affected by it. And, you know, it's not, you wouldn't think that. You think, we all know what the stereotype is that you think. And I know that one woman in our group collects obituaries from the paper of people that, you know, she can read the obituary and kind of tell that, oh, okay, this was a drug overdose. And it's mostly the young people that she's collecting for, because she doesn't even, it doesn't register. You know, if someone who is older passes away, there's many reasons that why this could be compared to younger people, if they pass suddenly. But it is affecting them as well.
Because what happened once I ran across is that there are some children that begin using heroin as early as the age of 12. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seemed really, mm-hmm. really, really early.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's scary how early that can be. And a lot of kids, I would say, if you're using heroin at the age of 12, it's some sort of self-medication. You know, you're taught in school, everyone knows that heroin is bad. There's steps that you do before you take heroin. You know, heroin is that last resort.
I mean, and in our society, heroin is like the big drug that everybody's thinking, you know, you may do lots of things, but this is like the wrong thing. And yet, mm-hmm. and yet we see this rise. I mean, obviously, as we indicated, it's cheaper, but that stigma of just the drug itself is just not, it's not enough to keep.
Yeah, well, the problem is that, you know, I think the medical field, we really need to look deeper into that, because the opiates are made of the same exact chemicals and things that the heroin is made from. So, you know, you think, oh, a doctor is prescribing this to me. This is safe to take. Or a doctor prescribed this to someone else. And, oh, you know, well, a doctor says it's okay. It's okay. But, you know, people really need to be aware of, you know, the consequences. I know that I was given opiates when I had my wisdom teeth removed, just like many people do. And, you know, my mom already was very aware of a lot of things since, you know, she was dealing and very worried about, you know, my brother in this case. And she was like, well, you should try and stop taking them as soon as you can. So I didn't finish my prescription of them. And, you know, and because she was in my ear about it, which is good, but I know that the doctors will prescribe 30 days worth of pain medication to people that don't need 30 days. You know, I read something the other day that the pain medicine that is sitting in people's cabinets is enough for, you know, the entire nation to be on pain meds for, I forget how long it was, but, you know, people hold on to this, maybe I'll need it for that, this or that, and, you know, it is the precursor to heroin because it's made up of the same things. You know, I think that people need to think twice, even if they are prescribed it, about using it. And I think that when people have it in their medicine cabinets, they need to figure out a way to safely dispose of it as soon as possible, because that's where kids are getting it from. You know, people go into open houses and look for it that way, too. And there are, I think, at least twice in Delaware a year, ways that you can dispose safely of it. They have drug take-back days.
By the way, do these is this a situation where the kids get into, say, for instance, this sort of the medicine cabinet, or is this also a problem where people are prescribed these things and then they just sort of go, I mean, what's
And Tyler had his wisdom teeth taken out during that freshman year at college. And I didn't know it at the time, but when we went back, they asked him, what I didn't know was they had already given him a prescription for pain medicine because he was having discomfort, and that's when he realized he needed his wisdom teeth out. So when we went back, the nurse asked him, are you still having discomfort? And he said, yeah. And she did give him another 30 days. And I found that to be alarming. And we've always been the type that we don't take anything unless we absolutely need something. You know, there's other ways of dealing with things, in my opinion. But that's just my opinion. So I think that the state of Delaware is educating the doctors. There's a Prescription Drug Action Committee led by Dr. Rattay and Dr. Rattan. And that has been a huge game changer in the prescription drugs. Unfortunately, what happened, and I think that our kids, Tyler included, they started experimenting with these pills, having no idea when they started that it was an opiate and what was going to become of it. But now, because they've taken hold of limiting the prescription drugs, that's the heroin spike.
These drugs are actually more powerful than heroin.
Yeah.
Fentanyl, for example, when you hear about the fentanyl laced, there were 11 deaths with fentanyl laced heroin in Delaware. It is many times more powerful than heroin itself. So if you don't have the fentanyl or the pain pills, you need to go to that. And people get in automobile accidents, get these pain pills, and become addicted. And they don't choose that; it kind of chooses them.
Now, it seems to me that this particular rise, particularly in overdose and heroin use, has caught state officials by surprise. I mean, certainly here in Maryland, there's a surprise at how quickly we had a stat just a moment ago, 33% increase in drug overdose, right? And much of that related to heroin and the fentanyl that you described. Clearly, there was not an anticipation when they decided to crack down on the prescription drugs in Delaware that there would be some alternative. I mean, is it a sense you get that the state officials were surprised, and how satisfied are you that they're reacting quickly enough?
Well, I'm not so sure that they were surprised. I think since 2009 in the state of Delaware, overdose have surpassed automobile deaths. And from 2009, I think they're aware that this issue was coming. I don't think there's been any major changes in the last 10 to 20 years as far as supplying places for young people to become addicts, to become get some help and rehab. So I think they're reacting now. It's slow. It's slow to react. The wheels turn slowly, but I think they're making steps. And I think we're fortunate that they have that we have been able to partner with them in trying to move this issue and get some action.
Well, finally, I wanted to ask you, there was a great war on drugs, and a lot of people were sent to prison. Your son didn't happen to be. But there seems to be now a shifting or changing of thinking about sending people to jail for drug possession. Are you optimistic that some kinds of major changes are going to be created, that the society is looking at this much differently than, say, they did when Nixon was president and they were talking about the war on drugs?
Yeah, I think Secretary Rita Langreth invited us to help her organize a forum that she was going to have with the top officials in the state. Senator Rob Coop, who heads the prisons, was there, judges, doctors. It was three-part, education, criminal, and medical. So I actually sat at the criminal justice table with Commissioner Coop, Corporal Setting from the county police, one of the judges from Kent County, and they all recognize that this needs to be treated medically. They're trying to work out how they're going to make this shift. And they do have a CREST and a KEY program in the state, which is for people who have become addicted and have crimes committed because of their addiction. And they're working on rehabilitating them, and they may be in there for a year. So they are doing an intensive program for those people who are addicted. But they're very well aware of it. Mrs. Markell, Governor Markell's wife, tells her story often of her mother and father, who her mother became a recovering addict. Her father never did, but she talked about how it affected her life and how this is her passion to make a difference. And they are very compassionate to our calls, and they're listening. They're listening. It's like Courtney said, it's your common middle of the road suburban families that are sitting here, and they're paying attention to what everybody has to say.
We were speaking with Donald Keister and his wife, Jeannie, as well as their daughter, Courtney. They are our founder of the group Attack Addiction, and they lost their son, Tyler, in 2012 at the age of 24 to a heroin overdose. And we appreciate you stopping by, and certainly our condolences.
Thank you.
This has been Delmar Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
In our world, ideas can be liturgy. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, generous conversation about the questions that matter most. What does it mean to be human? And how do we want to live? We explore with theologians, scientists, philosophers, thinkers, and activists every week from American Public Media.
Sunday mornings at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7.
We don't think about it until we must. A friend or a loved one suddenly tells us that they're terminally ill, that is, that they're dying. So what then? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Most of us are familiar with some of the statistics when it comes to major diseases. For example, the chance of dying from cancer is 22% for men and 19% for women. Or that heart disease is the number one cause of death for both men and women in the United States, taking around 1 million lives each year. And as we age and become more aware of death, there's another phenomenon, the growth of the U.S. hospice industry that has quadrupled since the year 2000. So today we tackle this uncharted territory of what to do when the time comes to care for someone who is dying. In studio, we have the authors of the book entitled Okay, Now What? A Caregiver's Guide to What Matters. So they are Sue Collins, a registered nurse for 40 years and also a hospice nurse for 28. And her co-author, Nancy Taylor Robson, a University of Maryland master gardener who has penned a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction, as well as written for the Baltimore Sun on the environment and sustainable living, among other topics. And Nancy, Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, let me just start out with something I think you is a quote I have from your book. It says, "Our long habit of living ill prepares us for dying." What do you mean by that, either one of you?
Well, we all get so used to just walking along and doing things every day, every day, every day that we think it's going to continue forever. And then suddenly you're brought up short and realize, oh, you mean like I'm going to leave too at some point? So that's, you know, it's a shock to everyone's nervous system.
Mm-hmm. How does that then affect us in terms of how we confront this? Is there a denial that goes on? I mean, what's that sense?
I think definitely there's a denial, especially when somebody has been diagnosed, you know, with a terminal illness or, you know, has a short, if their disease is progressing quickly, if they've had, like you were mentioning, maybe a heart disease or something. I think it's more like shell shock. As Nancy said, you don't expect it to come, and then here it is facing you, and then you're totally overwhelmed with what do I do, where do I go, what's next, and so many questions to answer that people just don't even know where to go, what to ask.
Now, for obviously, it's a shock to the person obviously who this is happening to, but yeah. There are their friends and the people who ultimately will care for them. How does the idea that we just sort of continue to live, that we live the way we live, does that prepare us at all for how to care for these people?
In some ways it does, because one of the things that we all have to remember about each other is that we're going to live the way we're going to die the way we live. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you're a party person and you never want to stop, that's not going to change. You're going to probably dial it up about 10 times and spend as much possible time as you can doing whatever it is you love to do until you simply cannot do it anymore. And if you think you can push someone around who's never been able to be pushed around before, you better rethink that, because it isn't going to work. You're going to have to figure out a new pathway. But human life is an ecology. And to figure out how we all can put out a hand and help each other and walk each other through all this as best we can, with as much grace and compassion and love as we can, without losing ourselves in the process. And that's what this book is about. It's really written for the caregivers, so that this is a really hard job. And it's easy to lose yourself and turn yourself over so completely to this that you lose yourself in the whole process. And figuring out how to do this, how to have a proactive approach to it all, and how to get the best possible outcome for everyone concerned. And this is not to say the outcome is not going to be terminal, but the person that's left is not there yet, and you're still going to have to figure out how to keep living.
Sue, you spent some time with hospice. Have you run into instances where people do exactly that, that they live the way they used to live, only they do, as she said, dial it up 10 times? Have
Absolutely.
You seen that happen?
Absolutely. Always, really. I mean, that's why we wrote about it, because personality, we say personality times 10. And, you know, I don't know why it seems to exacerbate, but it really does. And it can get ugly at times, and it can get funny at times.
You know, what do you mean by ugly?
Well, I mean, if they're, you know, a grumpy person, and maybe you don't like to spend a lot of time with them, well, now they're really grouchy, and it's really difficult, you know. And so when you're the caregiver who's trying to take care of that person, and you feel like they don't respect what you're doing or honor that, you know, you're taking time to help them, you know, it can be problematic. So we do address some of, you know, how to handle that.
Right.
Yeah.
Because as a matter of fact, you talk about the quote is, it's still their life. And that
yes.
is to say, you have to respect that. At the same time, you're trying to figure out how to deal with what you're talking about as sort of an acceleration of whatever personality they have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, an example I can give you is, you know, my father had congestive heart failure. And the summer, he died in August. And before he died, I could see his color changing. I could see him getting really pasty and gray. And I remember, you know, I called him up and I said, and here it is in August. He didn't want to have air conditioning. He had, you know, just fans. And I said, why don't you ask the doctor for some oxygen? And the response I got was, you don't tell the doctor what to do. And I'm not going to call him up. If he thinks I need oxygen, he'll give me oxygen. So, you know, that was just his way and his personality. And he wasn't going to tell the doctor what to do. And he wasn't going to take my advice either.
Yeah. Do you find people will do that, that they suddenly try to say, on the other hand, do you find that people, on the other hand, might say that they try to take control and try to figure out how to survive? I mean, is there a certain denial? Or, I mean, because that's not, I mean, it seems to me it's a process. I mean, somebody
right.
may tell you you're dying, but that doesn't mean you're going to accept it right away. You're going to check it out, try to figure out
sure.
there's some other way. I mean, is there at some point in that transition where they finally accept the idea that this is happening? I mean,
not everyone.
No.
Not everyone
yeah.
does.
Yeah.
My dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was told probably 18 months. Well, he actually lived for 3 years. I mean, we've got a piece in here that says the doctors don't have the calendar.
Right.
But he was one of these people who just went at life full bore. And he kept saying to me, I'm going to beat this. I'm going to beat this. And he kept sailing and he kept traveling and he had a rod in his leg, and he figured out how to get around doing that. And one thing he said to me that I thought, this is a man with very little patience in life. But one thing he said to me when I was doing his taxes for the last time, he said, you know, you'd be amazed at how you can adapt to adversity. And I thought, oh, that's going in my back pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of dealing with people, how do you deal then with people, or what techniques do you recommend in dealing with people who obviously they're not going to change? So, I mean, how do you deal with those particular kinds of personalities? I mean, you're talking about, like, you know, getting questions sideways as opposed
mm-hmm.
to, I mean, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I can give you an example of a disease. Let's think of COPD or emphysema.
Hmm.
My experience has been that a lot of folks who come into, you know, hospice which is where I work, and it's an inpatient unit, so we're talking about final days to maybe weeks. And oftentimes, these folks that have the COPD do not want to take the morphine, which will help really ease their breathing, because they don't want to lose control. You know, they're afraid of what it's going to do to them mentally. So they just kind of fight, fight, fight. So one of the approaches I've used with them is to say, you know, how are you feeling? They'll tell you that they're actually feel worse than they did, say, a couple months ago. And I'll use, like, an example of, well, think of your whole body as being on a treadmill 24/7. I mean, down to every cell is working overtime just to get some oxygen in. And if you just try a little bit of morphine, and just try it and see if it doesn't ease things up. And then I warn them that they may sleep because, you know, everything that's been working on the treadmill is waiting for a break. So, you know, you may sleep. Oftentimes they don't. And, you know, they might sleep for, you know, maybe an hour or so, but it's not like hours, and that's what they're afraid of. So each case is different, but I think, you know, you really have to be aware of the personality, and I think honesty is the best way to go. Just tell them, and again, the choice is theirs. So if, like in my father's case, he didn't want to take the oxygen, you know, that was hard for me to watch as a nurse, but that was his body, his choice.
Well, leads me to the next issue, which is, you know, what do the dying want? I mean, when you talk about sense of purpose and acceptance and so on, what is it that, as you particularly talk to a patient who is obviously terminally, what is it that they want?
From
a caregiver?
From a caregiver, I think, well, they want the honesty. They definitely want the honesty, and they want to be able to talk about what's happening to them. And we've talked about that in the book as well. I think oftentimes visitors and family and friends, they come and they don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. So they might say something that just sort of cuts off any kind of open communication that the person with the disease might feel they can, you know, they might want to talk to you about it. Like, this is how what I'm going through. This is how it feels. I'm worrying about this, this, or that. And if you come in and go, hey, you look great today, that conversation is probably not going to happen.
Or if, for example, they'll say something like, you know, you'll say, well, we're looking forward to so-and-so's wedding. I'm not going to make that. And if you say, oh, of course you are. You know, instead, if they think that, you start that with, like, well, what do you think about it?
Mm-hmm.
Give them an open opportunity. And if they don't want to continue any further, they won't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just be a little more directed. What is wrong with saying, saying exactly what you said, that is, well, no, we'll see you. What is that conflicting messages as opposed to the approach you take? I mean, why, I guess, because a lot of people say, well, why is that wrong? Why not extend, you know, hope even if it doesn't really exist?
It's a delicate balance, mm-hmm. and it depends upon the person. You know, my father really, he was scrapping for it until the last few weeks, and he was in a hospital bed and couldn't get up, but he was sailing. And he crawled on that boat until within about 6 weeks of when he died. And he, by this time, had a rod in one arm and a rod in a leg and was on, you know, it was not pretty. But he wasn't giving up. And if we had said anything to that effect to him, it would have been insulting to him. And we would have been disloyal. So we were going to play it whatever way he wanted to play it, really. But it's a matter of, if somebody gives you the opportunity to, you know, my mother-in-law did, in fact, kind of open up that just a little bit, just very gently. And she was not someone that wanted to discuss any of this at all. And it was just a matter of, you and I are okay. Yes, we're fine.
So you have a great Woody Allen quote about it. I'm not afraid to die. I just don't want to be there when it happens. I think most of us probably don't want to be there either.
Right.
But nonetheless, what do you mean by that? I mean, could you talk about listening to your body and that kind of, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by it, actually,
about you? Okay.
What I mean by that is that, you know, it's just, I want the transition, because I genuinely believe that this is not the last place we are, and our souls and our spirits are. I want the transition to be as peaceful a one as it can be. And I've seen very peaceful transitions. I was with my dad when he died. I was very glad I was. I was not with a very good friend who was a priest when he died, but I was very close to it. But I was able to come to him within the last couple of days and lean over and give him a kiss and say the same thing that he had always said to me is, until the next time.
Do you Do you find that to be the case that people do they look beyond? I mean, are they mostly spiritual when they're approaching?
A lot of them, yes, I do see that, and it's interesting for people who, you know, claim that they don't follow any organized religion. For instance, if a person comes into hospice and we ask, would you like to see the chaplain? And a lot of times it's no. But then towards the end, you know, they rethink it. Or they'll tell you, sometimes, you know, people will see, you know, dead relatives and hear things. And it's very comforting to them. It doesn't cause any distress. So I think that's really comforting for us, the observer, to know that that is a comfort for them, to have these experiences of seeing people and hearing music or, you know, just sometimes, you know, you can have a person who is in what we would call like a coma-like state, and they get this blissful smile over their face, you know. So something's going on. They're seeing something that's really good. And, you know, I mean, when they're not communicating and you're doing things to them physically, repositioning them, and you're getting no reaction, and yet this smile comes across their face, I think that's really, you know, comforting for us, the observers and the caregivers.
Because in the book, by the way, you indicate that hearing, you think, is probably the last thing to go. I mean, in essence, your message is that they can hear you.
Yes, they can hear you. So, and we were talking about that just before the show, that there was a young man who came in, and we've mentioned this in the book, who visited his mother, and she was in a coma, not responding, and he didn't know what to do, so he just sat there and talked, you know, like she was in the kitchen with him. You know, here's what the kids did today, and all on and on. And then she woke up. And when she woke up, you know, he said, oh, I came and visited you, and I was telling you, you know, about the kids, and I was talking to her. She goes, yeah, you talked my ear off. So that kind of validated, okay, you do hear, you know, and you do understand, and you're taking it in.
Yeah.
So...
One of the other things you talk about, though, is that even as a caregiver, obviously all this focus is on the person who is dying,
right?
But that you tell people you've got to like focus also on yourself, even though that creates, as you indicate, creates guilt.
Right. Well, it can create guilt. Well, I mean, worst case scenario is now the family has two people in the hospital. You know, might be having two people in the hospital, might have the patient in the hospital and maybe the caregiver,
right.
You know, and that's what you want to avoid. But basically, the book is really, our approach is to get all the practical things out of the way early, you know, any of the paperwork, gather your team, who's going to be able to support and help you. If you're the 24-hour caregiver, make sure you take time for yourself. If you're in a bowling league, try to get to the bowling league. Try to get somebody who can come in and fill in for that, because that's something you enjoy doing and you've been doing it and you should continue to do that. If you don't belong to any, you know, groups or whatever, and somebody calls up and says, you know, do you want to go out to dinner? Yes. The answer is yes. You do want to go out to dinner. You know, you can always find somebody to help, because other people who are not doing the 24-hour care do want to feel helpful, and they do want to feel useful. So sometimes the burden, again, is on the caregiver to make sure that happens, you know, because people always say to you, well, call me if you need me, you know. I mean, we've all done that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's great if the caregiver can say, okay, let's get the calendar out and start booking some things.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a good way to, you know, begin to take care of yourself.
And, you know, it's a good thing for the other people as well, because Beth, a friend of mine who's gone now, was fighting advanced cancer, and she and her husband had a company together. It was just the two of them. She had to go down. She had an hour twice a week that she had to drive down each way and then go through this chemo and then drive back and then same thing. So they set up a whole team of drivers. And there were volunteers in the community. They just sort of put out the word in the community. And there were volunteers in the community that didn't even know Beth. who did, and I talked to one of them later, who was he was a retired CEO, and he said, you know, I'd never done anything like that before, but the ride down with Beth and the ride back, he said, we talked about everything, and he said, I wouldn't have given up that time for anything.
So, I mean, is it certain real set, I mean, benefit, I guess, to even the caregiver?
Yeah, well, there's a real, that kind of thing is a benefit for it to have the help for the caregiver, definitely, and to feel like this whole thing is not completely on your shoulders, particularly if you're also working, or in my case with my brother and me, our children were young, we were both working, and my dad, we were fairly, you know, in our early 40s when my dad died. But in the case of say, Ernie, who was driving Beth, it's a gift to him, too. That, you know, that kind of connection and that sort of human relationship that he will carry with him, that's a real gift.
Now, I want to turn to the hospice because that's something that's actually, as I indicated, has been growing fairly fast in terms of services and so on. What are the requirements for going to the hospice? When's the right time? What, I mean, you've worked and...
Well, the requirements, as stated by Medicare, as of right now, because things are changing, is that you have a prognosis of 6 months or less, and that has to be certified in writing by two physicians, and it's usually the hospice physician and the personal physician. And so, you know, that is one avenue. You know, not everybody wants to go into hospice. Some people want to just stay at home and want to do this on their own, but that is the big requirement for hospice.
Would you recommend a hospice?
Well, after working there for 29 well, years, mean, I'd say yes.
Yes.
I love hospice.
What do you see as a benefit for people who particularly the caregiver who's looking at this?
I think the biggest benefit is the symptom management. Mm-hmm. That is it. I mean, hospice knows how to manage pain and breathing difficulties. If there's nerve involvement. And obviously there's going to be anxiety with all of that. We are really good at maintaining, you know, the symptom, managing the symptoms.
Now you talk about at the point that people are dying, and this shift, I guess, is what it's called, but there's a restlessness. Tell me a little bit about that because, I mean, I was not aware of this. For people who may eventually have to care for someone.
Well, let me give you an example. I was taking care of a woman not too long ago who had a restless night and just kept getting up to go to the bathroom, but you know, back forth, and really didn't go, you know, but felt this urgency. And actually, the night nurse put a catheter in her to see if her bladder, if she was retaining, and she wasn't. Well, I came in the morning and sat down with her, and I said, you know, gee, I heard you had a rough night, you know, a lot of restlessness. I said, do you feel like things are changing physically in your body? And she said, yes. And I just said, well, would you like to talk about that? And she just kind of looked at me and I said, you know, are you worrying about how things are going to happen? You know, how you're going to die? And she said, yes. And I just asked, would you like to talk about it? And so we did. And we had a really good open discussion and she asked questions and I answered them as honest as I could, and actually she felt a lot better after that. So that's what that restlessness was. I mean, getting up and going to the bathroom really wasn't, you know, that was the way it exhibited, but that wasn't really the issue.
Finally, yeah.
I was going to say, hospice, my mother-in-law had hospice in twice, actually. She had him in the year before she died, and then she dismissed them because she decided she wasn't dying. And then toward the very end, they came in within the last 2 weeks or so. And I think it was very, very helpful because her primary caregiver was a woman who lived with her who had no experience with this at all. And to have hospice come in with some expertise and some understanding, and they also prepped the family as well. My husband and I were down there, and they really prepped us for, here's what we're seeing, here's what it may or may not indicate. It's very helpful to have those kinds of guidelines from someone who's seen a lot of it.
I want to thank both of you for coming in, because I think this is a subject that I think most people don't think about. Certainly we don't. I mean, I had my father pass away a couple of years ago, and I must tell you that I really wasn't prepared for all the stages and didn't really recognize it, which is I think part of the medical establishment's problem in the sense that there's no controlling interest. There's no, okay, this is what's happening. You have to sort of figure it out. So I know I appreciate you coming by. Also, this is Sue Collins. She's a registered nurse for 40 years, also worked as a nurse as a hospice for 28 years. Also, her co-author, Nancy Taylor Robson, University of Maryland Master Gardener, who's penned a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction, as well as written for the Baltimore Sun on the environment, sustainable living, among other topics. We want to appreciate you coming in.
Thank you very much for having us.
And before we leave, we certainly want to recognize the passing of Liz Bellavance, a great supporter of this radio station. She died at the age of 77 from cancer, and she was also a big founder and supporter of Coastal Hospice as well. So we do want to keep her in our thoughts. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.